Hello? Hello?
Hello? Jane, it's me, James.
James, where are you?
I'm in Hamburg. I've traced Klugman, the Gestapo man who interrogated me.
Where? What's he doing now?
Well, apparently he lives in Amsterdam. He's a successful car dealer. I'm going to talk to him, see what I can find out.
Maybe he won't talk.
Maybe he will.
Of course, the price is negotiable, but...
It isn't the car I want to talk about.
Then what do you want to talk about?
You don't remember me.
We do have a lot of English and Irish people interested in our cars. I try to remember faces, but I'm afraid that I don't always succeed.
I'm thinking of way back, say, 1944.
That would be very unlikely, Mr. Fraser. I was in the army at that time.
Not quite the army, was it, Herr Klugman?
Who are you? Your name is not Fraser, is it?
No, it's Harmer. But when you and I met in 1944, you knew me under another name.
And what was that?
My code name was Archevêque. My field name was Hubert, Jacques Hubert. You interrogated me at the Gestapo building in Paris.
I make no secret of being a German, Mr. Harmer, yeah? I fought for my country as you did for yours.
I'm not too interested in what you did, Herr Klugman. I'm only interested in what I did.
I don't understand.
Do you remember the Seagull Network?
Of course. I was responsible for the arrests. It was the most successful operation we had in 1944.
What sort of information did you have on Seagull before you arrested Francois and the wireless operator?
Let me think. I can remember that we knew of a safe house in one of the small streets off the Rue de Varennes. Well, I can't remember its name. We had a good description of Francois, nothing much beyond that. But in the 2 weeks before we picked up Francois and the wireless operator, the SOE signals traffic was very insecure. In the last few weeks, they were ridiculously insecure.
In what way?
Addresses given instead of code names. A couple of references to operations that were sufficiently explicit for us to work them out. Our signals people said it indicated unusual pressure.
Were Seagull under that much pressure?
No, it wasn't Seagull who was insecure, it was London.
What? You mean signals from London actually gave addresses of safe houses?
Yes. We spent hours and days trying to work out what London were up to. We thought it must be a trap, you know, a radio game.
How did you find out where we were?
Oh, somebody, I think maybe one of the cryptographers, did a check on the signals traffic of your old network. What was it called?
Curfew.
That's it. And that was the breakthrough. There was a signal from London warning them to have no contact with you, but it gave you a location at the café.
You mean its code name or its actual name?
The actual name and the arrondissement. I don't think it gave the street, but that was no problem.
I don't believe it, Klugman.
What don't you believe?
That they gave away my location.
Well, we all thought it was a bit odd, but everything had got a bit odd about Seagull. We got the DF vans and set them up to check your wireless traffic. You tried two or three times to contact London, but they didn't come back to you. We checked to see if they were responding to other networks, and they were. That made us suspicious.
What did you suspect?
Ah, God knows. But the whole Seagull affair had become suspect. Nothing added up. It looked like London were deliberately throwing them all away, and you too.
So, what did you decide?
Oh, we left it to Berlin. They came back in about 2 days and told us to round up Seagull and you and the girl.
Are you telling the truth when you say that Francois and his operator didn't talk?
They didn't talk, I assure you.
Was there a traitor among our network?
Absolutely not. In fact, we were rather sorry for you all. Everybody held out, more or less. But you got no support from London. If it hadn't been for their insecurity, we probably wouldn't have got any of you. I tell you, Their lack of elementary signal security in the last 2 weeks would have got them court-martialed if they'd been on our side.
When did you get back from Amsterdam?
4 days ago.
Why didn't you contact me sooner?
Let me tell you. I talked with Klugman.
What did he say?
He said that London gave us away.
What?
They passed signals to my old network and other groups that said in clear where we were. London threw us away, Jane. And I know who it must have been.
Who?
Carter. It all fits in now. I know what the German told me.
We'd never be able to prove it, Jamie.
Well, I'm not interested in proving it. Carter's going to tell me.
He wouldn't dare tell you. And anyway, he might just have been carrying out orders.
He'll tell me, and no honourable man would carry out such orders. I've been checking up on him in the last few days. I know where he lives, and he's got a young girl in a flat in Fulham. She'll be the stakeout. Oh, well, I'll get on my way then. Oh, tell me just one thing. You didn't really believe it was me, did you?
Not really, Jamie. It just didn't fit.
Take care of yourself.
Yes?
Oh, good evening, miss. I'm a police officer. My car's broken down. I'd be very grateful if you'd let me use your phone. I won't be more than a couple of minutes.
Got any identification?
Of course.
Okay, you'd better come in.
Thanks.
Who is it?
It's a policeman, Monty. Wants to use my phone.
Shan't be a moment, sir. Just a call to transport.
Oh, that's all right.
Harmer?
Huh?
My God, James Harmer. How are you?
I'm sorry, I don't think we... Carter? Carter? Well, I'm blessed. I'm fine, how are you?
Very well. Never been better, old chap. And you're a copper now.
Uh-huh.
I bet you're a damn good one. Where are you stationed?
Maidstone. Detective Chief Superintendent. Kent County Constabulary.
Well done, well done. This is a friend of mine, Penny Watkins.
Hello.
How do you do?
She's my part-time secretary. Look, I tell you what, make your call, old boy, and then let's go round the corner and have a pint for old Lang Syne.
Why not?
So how's life treating you?
Don't get a moment's relaxation. The bank takes every minute. One damn thing after another.
Why don't you take some time off?
Oh,
you could have my boat on the Medway.
What?
Yeah.
You know, that's a pretty good idea. I'd like to take you up on that. I could take young Penny.
Sure.
No, so do you really mean it?
Of course I do. Well, why not come down on Friday evening, stay till Sunday? You might as well enjoy the last of the summer.
Right, well, look, scribble your phone number out for me. Hmm. I'll phone you tomorrow.
Morning, Carter. Brought you a Sunday paper.
Hello, James. Thank you.
Where's the young lady?
Oh, I took her to the station this morning. She'd had enough of peace and quiet.
You know, I never knew your Christian name.
Monty.
Ah.
Montague Rayner, those are the prefixes. A drink, old boy? Or is it too early for you?
Why'd you send me to Paris, Monty?
Huh? Sorry, what did you say?
All those years ago, why did you send me to Paris?
What the hell are you on about? What is this, an interrogation? You know damn well why you were sent to Paris. You had orders, you were briefed, you had documentation.
Go on.
Well, there isn't any more, old boy. They picked you up and that was an end of it.
But why did they pick me up?
Well, God knows, you must know why better than I do.
Oh, I don't think so, Monty.
What do you mean?
What exactly did you send me to do?
Well, what did your orders say?
To keep the Seagull network under surveillance and report to London.
Exactly.
Why did you close down the wireless on me?
Because you were endangering Seagull, and you were disobeying orders.
Seagull's wireless operator and leader were arrested before I got to Paris. The rest would have been inside a week.
Well, they were in a matter of days anyway, even with you in charge.
Who told them where we were? Who gave them the safe house addresses?
How the hell should I know? You were there. Who do you think told them?
I think you told them.
God, this is ridiculous. I'll have to report all this, you know.
Why did you give safe house addresses instead of code names in your signals?
We didn't know where you were, Harmer, so we couldn't have done that.
I'm talking about the Seagull safe houses, not mine.
You never saw Seagull radio traffic. Their operator was arrested the day before you arrived.
Answer me, Monty.
Why? I don't have to listen to all this rubbish.
You did do it. The Germans told me so.
Oh, they were bluffing, trying to break you down.
Oh, they didn't tell me then. The case officer told me a few days ago. I'm going to kill you, Carter, unless you tell me what I want to know.
For God's sake. It was policy. Nothing to do with me.
Go on.
There was a vital network working between Paris and Cherbourg. They were in a special team sent over to prepare for D-Day, right in the landing area. We had to keep the Germans off their backs. We shoved the Krauts a bit towards Seagull to keep them occupied and away from the others.
How many lives did betraying Seagull save?
God knows. I'm not a bloody soldier.
So why did you send me?
To check what was happening. We would have withdrawn you after the Seagull people had been taken if you hadn't interfered.
And because I interfered, you threw me and the girl to the Gestapo along with the others.
Nobody was thrown away. You came back, for God's sake. You're alive. You've done well.
Who worked all this out?
I was told to give protection to the Penguin Circuit. That was the only way.
Have you ever thought about what happened to all of us?
Of course I have. But it's very much to be regretted. It was a necessity of war.
Do you remember a man with a field name, Albert?
No.
He's in a French asylum. Been there ever since the war.
Oh, come on, Jimmy. Join me in a drink. It was all a long time ago and best forgotten.
I don't drink.
Oh, now look, Jimmy.
What do you make of it, Keating?
Almost certainly murdered, Chief Inspector.
How?
Ah, that's why I said almost certainly murdered, but not where he was found. There's a whole series of broken blood vessels down the right side. Well, that occurred after death, probably when the body was thrown down. There are typical signs of asphyxia, a pinpoint hemorrhaging in the eyes and under the scalp.
Strangled?
No, there are no marks of strangling, but what there is a massive bruising under the left ear. Someone has applied enormous pressure there. More than just normal pressure from a finger or thumb. It's a nerve pressure point. And I'd say he died in 5 to 15 seconds. Certainly not longer.
Could the pressure have been applied by a blow from something?
No. A blow from anything would have had to break open the skin to apply that kind of force. I'd say it was pressure from a thumb or knuckle, applied by a man with special knowledge.
What kind of special knowledge?
He'd need to know that pressure applied at that precise point could kill a man.
You mean a doctor?
Could be. An osteopath? A vet, even. A wrestler.
When shall I get your report?
Preliminary, midday today. Full report in about 3 days.
Driving license valid until 30th of November, 58. Name M.R. Carter, address 49 Kings Avenue, Wimbledon. Membership card, Cockatoo Club, no dates, no name. Pigskin wallet, worn, containing 2 £5 notes, 2 £10 notes, 3 £10 notes. Photograph of man and woman in garden, 2 joined half tickets for the Aldwych Theatre. 9 visiting card, M.R. Carter, director, Coulthard's Bank, London and Singapore. Photograph approximately 2¼ inches square of naked girl. Mm-hmm. Wristwatch, Rolex chronometer, black leather strap. Playing card with various notes in pencil and ink. Looks like directions. Finger ring, 1 diamond, 18 karat gold. A 6 packet of Durex, 2 missing. Parker 51 pen, metallic blue. Checkbook, Barclays Bank, 2 checks used. Wimbledon High Street branch. And that's it. Well, you better check that Wimbledon address, Phillips.
On my way, sir. I'd just like to go over your statement one more time, Mrs. Carter. You said that your husband told you that he'd be away for the weekend, staying with an old army friend.
That's right.
Did he give you an address?
Well, there wasn't an address. They were staying on a boat.
What was his friend's name, Mrs. Carter?
I think it was Harper. A name like that.
And where was the boat?
I don't remember.
The Medway?
I don't think it was mentioned.
What did he take with him?
A case.
What size case?
A weekend case.
And you've not heard from him since?
Yes, as I said in my statement, he phoned me on the Saturday about midday.
Did he say where he was phoning from?
No, but it was a reverse charge. The operator said a call box in Maidenhead.
In Maidenhead?
Is that wrong?
Could it have been Maidstone?
Oh, yes, it could.
What did he say?
Nothing much. He was having a pleasant, restful time with his friend, and He'd be back about 8 or 9 on Sunday evening.
And that was the last you heard from him?
Yes.
Is that a photograph of your husband?
Yes, that's my husband. You found him, haven't you?
I'm afraid we have.
Where is he?
Maidstone Hospital.
Does that mean he's still alive?
There's been an autopsy. Oh. Look, are you alone here, Mrs. Carter?
Yes.
Have you a relation or friend who could come over?
Only my sister.
Where does she live?
In Putney.
Is she on the telephone?
Yes. My phone book's on the hall table. Her name's Mary. Mary Fielding.
Well, you sit there. I'll call her.
Is it all right with you to start, Mr. Rose?
By all means.
First of all, let me say, Miss Watkins, that we appreciate you coming forward. We'll keep you out of it as far as we can. Now, you say in your statement that you recognised the photograph of the deceased in the newspaper. You contacted your solicitor, Mr. Rose, here, and made the statement. You state that you knew Mr. Carter over a period of nearly 3 years. How old were you when you first met him?
17.
Right. Now, your statement ends where he invited you to stay for one night with him on a boat. Can you describe the boat and where it was?
It was near a village called Yolding, moored near a caravan site. I could take you there. The boat was quite big, wooden, and the main part was painted white with a blue line.
Do you know who it belonged to?
To a friend of Monty's.
Do you remember this friend's name?
No, but I'd know it if I heard it again.
Can you describe him?
He was quite a big man, nearly 6 foot tall, reddish hair. A nice man.
Was the friend on the boat all the time?
Oh, no. He was just there on the first evening for about 10 minutes, showing Monty where the things were, the gas and so on.
Were they on good terms?
Oh, yes, they were very friendly.
They knew one another well?
Yes, from the war.
Where did the friend live?
Somewhere round about Maidstone.
How do you know that?
He said so.
Any idea what sort of job he had?
He was a policeman.
How do you know that?
He said he was. He and Monty hadn't seen each other for years, and his car broke down outside my flat when Monty happened to be there. He used my phone to ring Scotland Yard for help, and then he and Monty went out for a drink.
How old was he, approximately?
A bit younger than Monty.
Between, say, 40, 45?
Yes.
Did he say what rank he was?
Can you tell me some?
Oh, constable, sergeant, inspector, superintendent.
That's it, superintendent.
Quite sure that when he phoned Scotland Yard, he said superintendent?
Yes.
Did any help come for his car?
Yes, I saw a squad car from the window after he left.
Did he say what he was doing to be near your flat?
I don't think so. I can't really remember.
I want you to think very carefully. Back to that phone call to Scotland Yard. Try and remember anything you can. Don't hurry.
I can't remember any more.
Fair enough. Now, I just want to go back to the name. You're sure you can't remember the name?
No, I can't remember it. But I think I'd know it if I heard it again.
Was it Phillips?
No.
Harmer?
Yes, that was it, Harmer.
You're quite sure that was the name?
Yes, absolutely sure.
Mr. Rose, would you have any objection to your client making a signed statement now at Chelsea Police Station?
Provided that no information on a statement is given to the media, I would have no objection.
Put me through to Detective Inspector Phillips.
Yes, sir. Phillips here.
Hale's here.
Yes, sir.
Take two of my men on one side and put them on a round-the-clock surveillance of Detective Chief Superintendent Harmer. Full time. Do you understand?
No, sir.
Well, just do as I say. I'll explain when I see you.
You're sure about this, sir?
Yes, I wish I weren't. But there's still a long way to go.
Right, sir.
It just doesn't fit, Frank. Jimmy Harmer's an experienced detective. If he wanted to knock somebody off, he wouldn't leave all that stuff around.
No.
There's been no effort to conceal anything, not even a body. He'd know that it was only a matter of time before it was found.
He'll know that the girl can witness that he knew Carter and that Carter had been on his boat.
Yeah, right.
But he hadn't even seen Carter for years. He only met him by chance. What the hell motive is there?
Maybe we'd better ask Jimmy Harmer himself.
Not bloody likely. I'm going to talk to the chief constable and the yard before I go near him.
Well, the evidence against him doesn't amount to much. You can prove opportunity, but that's all. No evidence of motive or anything to connect him to the killing. Could have been somebody else.
Exactly. But now that we've got a suspect, Keating can start looking at it all over again.
I don't think you stand a chance in court, Chief Inspector.
It's the only real lead I have, sir.
Too bad.
But if I could question him, I could probably get a lot more.
You mean charge him and then question
him? No, just ask him to answer a few questions to assist my inquiry.
What do you think, Grover? You're the legal eagle.
Well, there's no reason why the chief superintendent shouldn't answer questions to help an inquiry. He'll probably say that he knew Carter, lent him his boat, and that's it. There's nothing to connect him further.
There is, sir.
What?
Harmer will have seen the papers or listened to the news. He must know about Carter's death. Why hasn't he contacted Maidstone?
Maybe he hasn't read the papers or listened to the news. You said he was off sick, so he may be confined to his bed.
And why hasn't he been to the boat since the Sunday morning visit? Surely he'd want to check that they'd left it shipshape and safe, and surely he'd contact Carter about the weekend. Did he enjoy himself and all that?
I agree, that would be the normal pattern, but it doesn't mean anything in court terms. And like I said, he may still be confined to bed.
How are you feeling, sir? Any better?
I'm Chief Inspector Hales. I'd like to ask you some questions, if I may. Tell me what happened. Was it an accident? You're a policeman, same as me. Don't make it difficult for us both. When did you last see Carter? Look, I don't want to do it, but if you don't answer my questions, I'm going to have to take you into Maidstone and question you there. Formally. James Harmer, I'm a police officer, and I'm making inquiries into the death of Montague Rayner Carter. I believe you can help me with my inquiries, and I must ask you to accompany me and Detective Inspector Phillips to Maidstone Police Station.
It's the Chief Constable and Chief Inspector Hales, Mr. Armour. Just walk in. Ah, yes. Would you sit down, Chief Superintendent? Is there anything I can do for you, James? They tell me that you have refused to answer even routine questions. Would you like to see a doctor? Would you like to talk to me off the record? The Chief Inspector is investigating a murder, and it seems that you knew the victim and that he was last seen on your boat. I would like to ask if anything untoward happened that you know of. Carry on, Hales.
James Harmer, I arrest you on suspicion of the murder of Montague Rayner Carter on or about the 28th of September, 1953. Anything you say may be written down and used.
Press the bell when you've finished, Mr. Fraser.
Well, it's good to see you, Jamie. You're in this godforsaken place. First of all, let me tell you about Jane. She only discovered what had happened a couple of days ago. She was very distressed. As you know, she thinks the world of you. She sent for me to see what could be done. Would you talk with me?
Yes. I'll talk to you.
Jane thinks she knows why this happened. I'm not going to talk about it in any detail in this place, but I can say that I think there would be an excellent defense if Jane's theory were correct. You understand what I mean? Jane told me most of what happened both recently and back in the war days. I understand your feelings, and I think there are others would understand too. Mother and I were always very fond of you, right from that Christmas, way back. Money for top counsel would be no problem. I've got far more than I shall ever need, and Jane is already well provided for. So, please, can I help you?
We can never prove what they did. There'll be no records. They'll have destroyed them long ago. Nobody would admit what had been done to us.
We could subpoena anybody you felt might have information.
And they wouldn't talk. They'd just sell me down the river again.
All of them?
There was probably only one other involved.
Do you know who he was?
No idea. But whoever it was, he wouldn't talk. They wouldn't let him.
A good cross-examiner could prise it out of him.
They'd hide behind the Official Secrets Act.
That would make a point for you.
Oh, no, they'd see to that. They threw us all away once. They'd throw me away now. They don't really have any choice.
Why did they do it, Jamie?
To distract the Germans from another SOE network that was preparing for the D-Day landings.
Why not say this in court?
Who would believe me? I haven't any evidence. I wouldn't have known myself if I hadn't forced it out of Carter.
He must have felt terrible when he had to do that.
He didn't care. He tried to justify it. It was an order, so he just carried it out.
What can I do for you?
Take care of Jane. Tell her I cared. I just couldn't bear to think what he'd done to us all.
There's still a chance they may acquit you.
I don't care what they do. I squared things off, and that's what mattered. But in the end, I couldn't bring myself to run away.
Would you like Jane to come and see you?
No. She'll understand why not.
Read the indictment.
Yes, my lord. James Harmer, you are accused of the murder of Montague Rayner Carter on or about the 28th day of September in the year of our Lord 1953. How do you answer?
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I am afraid that at this point it is necessary for me to explain a point of law to you. When a defendant does not reply to questions that are legally and correctly put to him, the court has to decide between two issues. Is the defendant what is called in law mute of malice, that is to say, able to speak, but refusing to do so, or is he mute by visitation of God, that is to say, temporarily or permanently unable to speak? There is no doubt in my mind that the defendant stands mute of malice. The second point that I want to draw your attention to is that the court has appointed learned counsel to act as what we call amicus curiae, the friend of the court, to act on behalf of the defendant. And the learned counsel who has been appointed raised no objection to my finding that the defendant stands mute of malice. The defendant has not spoken or responded to questions from the moment of his arrest. And this leads me to my final point. I want you to know that it is a matter of law that a defendant has the right to remain silent. During the trial, and when you retire to consider your verdict, you will not read into the defendant's silence any implication of guilt. Guilt is for the prosecution to try and establish, and for you alone to decide.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it is the prosecution's intention to put before you evidence that will convince you that the defendant committed the act of murder on the deceased Montague Carter. But before I come to that evidence, there is something that I want to bring to your attention. The occupation of the accused. He is a very senior police officer, a detective chief superintendent of the Kent County Constabulary, no less. It is my duty to point out to you that that has no bearing on this case. You may feel that a senior police officer is either less or more likely to commit the crime of murder, but the defendant in any murder trial is a man or a woman, nothing more. He or she may be titled, eminent, famous, or otherwise virtuous, but when he stands in the dock in this court, he has to be considered as innocent until you decide that he is guilty. Turning now to the evidence that I will put before you, I start with the finding of the body. On the afternoon of the 10th of March, a sales representative came upon a body lying in a wood near the village of Yalding in Kent. You are Penelope Margaret Watkins, and you live at 27A Bedford Street, Notting Hill. Is that correct?
Yes.
How long had you known the deceased?
Nearly 3 years.
You had a very close relationship with him?
I slept with him.
Ah, yes. And you and the deceased went down to Yalding on the evening of the 26th of September, a Friday?
Yes.
Right. And you also met another man at that time, the owner of the boat?
Yes.
Can you see him in this court?
Yes, he's the man sitting between the two policemen.
I see. Did you see much of that man during the weekend?
No. He was there for a short time when we arrived, and then he left.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, when this trial started, his lordship instructed us on the subject of the defendant's silence. He told us that such silence should not be interpreted as guilt. Now, I want to remind you of that. It is the defendant's right not to answer questions. It is as much his right as any other right granted by the law. And when his lordship warned you that no guilt should be attached to that silence, he meant no guilt, not even the smallest prejudice. The defendant is exercising such a right in remaining silent in this court. Exercising that right makes him neither innocent nor guilty. It leaves him a neutral status. Now, my learned friend representing the Crown told you that the Crown does not need to establish motive, and that is perfectly true. However, the absence of evidence on motive is significant. Now, there are usually only two reasons why such evidence is not put forward. The first is that although the motive is known or suspected or patently obvious, it cannot be proved. The second reason can be that there is no motive on the part of the defendant for the simple reason that he or she did not commit the crime. Now, I won't dwell on this, but I don't want you to be misled by my learned friend's comments on motive. If the Crown could have put forward motive, I have no doubt they would have done so. I come now to the evidence which the Crown has put before you. It strikes me as being like one of those boxes of chocolates called assortments. Try this strawberry cream. And if you don't like that, try the marshmallow. And if you don't fancy that, then there's always the one with the nut. There was a little something for everybody and nothing much for anybody. And when it came to establishing that a murder had been committed, we heard the evidence of an eminent forensic scientist. But in my opinion, that merely established the cause of death. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that the Crown did not establish that murder was committed. And when we listen to the parade of those who the Crown suggests would have the necessary strength and knowledge to commit such a murder, we are indeed in a very strange company. Wrestlers, surgeons, veterinary surgeons, I won't go on. But you will notice that detective chief superintendents were not on that list.
I come then to the character of the defendant. You have heard his superiors, his colleagues, and his juniors testify that he is an excellent police officer, doing his job with impartiality and skill, with respect for the public and the law. However, I must point out to you that we are not considering here whether detective chief superintendents of police are capable of committing murder, but whether this particular man, the defendant, has committed murder on the evidence put before you. There are no difficult points of law for me to explain to you. This is not what is sometimes called a judge's case, bristling with intricate points of law. It is very much a jury case, where your own common sense will be most important. You will be taken by the bailiff to your jury room, and your foreman will notify the bailiff when you are ready to give your verdict.
What do you feel?
I'm damned if I know. It was a messy trial.
That couldn't be helped.
So, why did you bring it to trial?
My masters wanted it. Mine but to do and die.
How long do you think they'll be out?
If it's over a couple of hours, they'll find him guilty. Have you picked up any tittle-tattle as to why he wouldn't talk?
No, not a thing. He hasn't said a word to me.
That must have been pretty frustrating.
No, not really. It's just another case as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Foreman of the jury, do you find the defendant guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Is that the verdict of you all?
It is.
Have a whiskey with me, Jeanie. It'll help you get to sleep.
I don't like whiskey, Father. You know that.
Doesn't matter. Have one with me just to celebrate.
You're a cunning man, you know.
Well, that's wisdom, not cunning. What's worrying you, girl?
I've been tempted to phone him. He must feel terribly lonely and deserted.
Oh, I think you're probably right.
You mean I should phone him?
No. I mean that he will be feeling lonely and deserted. But not deserted by you. Much as you loved him, I'm sure that by now you're only a postscript in his life.
I don't understand.
He was always lonely. He was a lonely boy. He had a lonely childhood without warmth and affection. He was a lonely young man. And then came the war, and he did a job that absolutely fitted him. People wouldn't have described him then as lonely. There was a more romantic word. He was a loner, and it was loners who survived in that sort of work. I met you, and I suspect that you were the only person in all his life that he ever felt love for. And then he was betrayed. You all were. Some of you came back. Some of you survived better than others. Some just existed, like the man you told me about in the asylum. Somebody high up decided that a handful of people should be thrown to the wolves. Nobody will ever know if it was justified. One man, your Jamie, would never see it as justified. His kind of people don't do things like that for any reason. To find that his kind of people did, and thought nothing of it, would be almost worse than the things you all suffered in the camps. To him, what he did, if he did it, will have been far more than just squaring the account. To him they used his loneliness, his courage, and then threw him away. And the rest of you with him. It takes a different kind of courage to face up to that. He hasn't got that kind of courage. That kind of courage comes from having self-confidence, friends, and a background. He never had that.
So what do I do?
For him or for you?
For him.
Nothing. You leave him alone. That's what he chose when he first set out to confront Carter. He knew what he was doing. And he'll know what he's going to do now. He's that kind of man.
And for me?
I suggest you close down your flat and come back here where you're loved and cherished. Keep on your translations and read Victorian novels.
Why Victorian novels?
Because in those days women found it possible to love just one man in a lifetime. If he didn't come back from the wars, they went on loving him, and no other.
I wish Jamie was being loved and cherished.
It's too late for that, my love. That has to start when you're a child.
You're a wise old bird, and I'm terribly glad I've got you and Mother.
I'm not all that wise. I'm much the same as your Jamie. I'm a black and white man. I don't believe in the grey bits. It's not popular these days, but it means I know where I am. And so does he.
Oubliez, s'il vous plaît. Merci, monsieur.
Pardon, monsieur. À quelle heure arrivons-nous à Paris?
À 6h30.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Evening. Do you still rent rooms?
Of course. How long for?
Just the night.
Haven't I seen you before?
The room.
Oh. There are two rooms up these stairs. Take your choice. Pay me later. Here's the keys.
And now, cricket.
England's team for the second test match, starting in Sydney tomorrow, will be Hutton, Bailey, May, Graveney, Cowdrey, Edrich, Evans, Tyson, Wardle, Statham and Bedser. And news has just come in that the senior police officer found not guilty in a recent murder trial has been found dead in a small hotel in Paris. No further details are available.
The last time I saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay. No matter how they change her, I'll remember her.
In The Lonely Margins by Ted Albury, Christian Rodsker played Harmer, Kim Thompson, Jane, Ian Cuthbertson, Mr. Fraser, and John Badley, Carter. Carl During was Klugman, Simon Cuff, the defense QC, Stephen Rashbrook, the prosecution QC, Alan Dudley, the chief constable, Caroline Gruber, Miss Watkins, Norman Bird, the judge, Eva Stewart, Mrs. Fraser and Mrs. Carter, Stephen Harold, Pierre, Lawrence Payne, Inspector Hales, Michael Tudor Barnes, Inspector Phillips, John Sampson, Keating, and William Simons, Grover. The play was directed by Matthew Walters.